Okay, good morning. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut. As is well known, the first half of the Book of Exodus is narrating events which often seem to contravene the laws of nature. In the language of the Torah, these are described as otot and moftim, as signs and wonders. In the more vernacular, we might call these things miracles. Of course, when you see incidents like this narrated, it raises a red flag if you think philosophically. The Bible narrates these things very casually, without self-consciousness, as if this is a completely normal thing, that plagues would come and seas would split and so on. But once you apply a lens of philosophical thinking, it raises certain questions. And the question of whether you think that the events that are narrated in the Torah are perfectly plausible expressions of the way God interacts with the world, or fantastical explanations that come from a superstitious mind, depends on what your vision of God is, what you think the nature of God is, and whether you can imagine God intervening in history. And that raises a whole number of questions that we want to look at in this talk. The question and the problem, the dilemma, is very nicely and clearly summarized by Professor Kenneth Zieskind in source number one. Let's read together. According to the Bible, the Israelites were rescued from certain death when God parted the Red Sea. There is, however, no independent evidence that this event took place. So believing in it is not like believing in the French Revolution or the American Civil War. The Bible claims, as no standard history book does, that its story is sacred. It's the record of divine involvement in human affairs. To talk about divine involvement, however, is to talk about signs and wonders that form the backbone of the biblical narrative. It is to talk about miracles. The formative events in the history of Judaism are often ones which defy human or mechanical explanation. That's why they're said to offer proof that Hashem is God. Since the Enlightenment, such quote-unquote proof, that is to say that the Torah is true, may have turned into a stumbling block. It's not merely that the events in the Bible are not corroborated by other sources. According to arguments offered by Spinoza and Hume, and we'll take a look at them a bit later, it's irrational to believe that any such events occurred. And if, as Maimonides insisted, Judaism does not contain anything abhorrent to reason, how can it encompass the miraculous? Well put. Let's take it step by step, beginning with the events that are narrated. Some samples here in sources 2 and 3. In source 2, this is in Parshat Shmot, Hashem says to Moshe, take with you this rod with which you'll perform the otot, the signs. And interestingly there, the commentator of Avadya Sforno says, because I've appointed you to change the course of nature upon your command. So the Sforno is explicit about it. When you stick out that staff, you're actually going to contravene the laws of nature. It's not going to be naturalistic. It's going to be something supernatural. And of course, the most famous example in source 3, in Parsha B'Shalach, where Moshe stretches out his hand over the sea and God drives the sea back with a strong east wind and turns it into dry land. And the famous narrative, the waters were divided, the Israelites went through the sea on dry land, a wall of water on their right and left. The Egyptians pursue them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots. And then God looks down from a pillar of fire and throws the Egyptian army into confusion and jams the wheel of the chariots. And then Hashem said to Moshe, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. Moshe did just that, and the sea returns to its place. And of course, as we know, the Egyptians are drowned. The entire army that followed the Jews into the sea are drowned. But the Israelites go through on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. So you'd say to yourself, okay, what's wrong with that? God is God. God can do whatever God wants. And so if God wants to split the sea and have people come through, that's fine. And if he wants to cover it back over with water, that's fine too. But it's not quite fine for Maimonides. And why it's not fine for him and how he tries to find a solution to this problem is what we're going to take up next. It has to do in some ways with the sorts of worldview that he accepts in the 12th century, the Aristotelian heritage that he has inherited and transformed Jewishly, but that he's deeply influenced by. So we're going to look at a series of passages in Maimonides and try and be really clear about what they mean and what they imply. Let's begin with source 4. This is from The Guide of the Perplexed, written in 1190, Dalalat al-Ha'irin in Arabic, Mora Nevuchim in Hebrew. Source number 4. Aristotle asserts, though he does not do so textually, but this is what his opinion comes to, that in his opinion, it would be an impossibility that will should change in God or a new volition arise in him. It's impossible that a volition should undergo a change in God or a new will arise. This is from Book 2, Chapter 13. Put simply, Maimonides, citing Aristotle, says it's not possible that God changes his mind or comes up with a new thought or acts on a new thought. Why is this so? Why is Aristotelian theory committed to no change of will or choice or option in God? So this is explained nicely in source number 5. According to Maimonides, the Aristotelian theory is committed to a universe that operates according to a fixed and unyielding pattern, a universe without free will. As we normally use the term, free will presupposes the ability to change your mind. Suppose there are two ways to reach a destination, a scenic way and a fast way. If I'm a free agent, then having chosen one, I'm at liberty to change my mind and choose the other. But with respect to God and creation, the ability to change implies that at one moment there's no universe, and then God decides to change this situation and bring the universe into being. This change of mind is said to constitute an instance of divine volition. In other words, God makes a choice, wills something that isn't there into being. Maimonides' position is that by denying creation, the Aristotelians also deny that God can do anything different from what he has always done. In short, they maintain that God is invariant and can never initiate new action. Okay, pause. This is true. For Aristotle, God is not like the God in any way, shape, or form like the God narrated in the Bible. The God narrated in the Bible not only displays emotion, some nice, some not so nice, but it displays often changes of mind and sometimes seemingly capricious or irrational changes of mind. I don't like the world. Let's destroy it. I don't like the Sodomites. Let's destroy them. I don't like what the Jews are doing. Let's bring a plague, and so forth. For Aristotle, this is an impossibility because his vision of God is not personal and is more or less mechanistic. God is like the first cause of all the other causes, like a chain, like a ball that sets off another ball and another ball and another ball. It's a kind of predetermined slot in the chain, and you can't move it and you cannot change it. Why? Why is he committed to this vision of divinity? It goes like this. Read the last paragraph of the source with me. The crux of the Aristotelian argument is that change, and therefore free will, is incompatible with the concept of a perfect being. If something is already in a perfect state, it is not striving to attain perfection, but has already achieved it. Change would involve deterioration. If God is perfect, there's no superior condition to which a change could take him. Thus, the Aristotelians argue that God's activity is constant, his perfection is completely actualized, he has no decisions to consider, no potential to develop. You see where they're going with this. Change indicates something's not right. Something has to be fixed, altered. But if things are perfect, they don't need fixing or altering. Why should God do something else? God is God. God is perfect. So there's a kind of syllogism, right? God is perfect. Change equals imperfection. God cannot change, right? It's as simple as that if you boil it down in a nutshell. Therefore, from Aristotle's point of view, any narrative that would show God suddenly deciding to do X and then Y and then Z is completely incompatible with a perfect being. And therefore, the Bible does not narrate correctly. Maimonides is in a pickle because he's committed to Aristotelian rationality. In other words, he really does believe this is correct. but he is also deeply committed to divine freedom, to the idea that God, by nature, should be able to change if God wanted to, because after all, if that's not the case, then God's kind of stuck. It's a way of saying God is more stuck than you or I, right? That is quite a philosophical quandary for Maimonides. I want a God who's free, and I want a God who's perfect, and the truth is that the logic doesn't work. It's hard to make, to square the circle here. That's a deep, deep dilemma for rationalist philosophy when it comes to the Bible. And he kind of rehearses the Aristotelian argument in source number 6. By the way, that very nice summary again from Professor Ziskin in source 5. In source number 6, guide 218, Maimonides writes, "Does not the supposition that one wishes at one time and does not wish at another time imply in itself change?" He's giving expression to it, like if I don't want to and then I do want to, I'm changing. And that somehow doesn't fit with the picture of God. On the other hand, he is a defender of tradition. And the traditional view, of course, is that God at least has as much freedom as you and I to do what God wants. And the Aristotelian position completely removes any vestige of divine freedom. God is, in a sense, stuck in Aristotle's cosmology. As I said, he's just a ball in a chain, and balls in a chain don't make independent decisions. They just do what they're supposed to do as part of a mechanistic universe. That is upsetting for Maimonides. He gives expression to the idea of the complete elimination of divine freedom and his unsettled feeling about it in source number 7. No, here he's talking about Aristotle's belief that the world was not created in time, was not ex nihilo, but rather that the universe is eternal. And Maimonides says that if I accept this position, the narrative of the Torah absolutely vanishes. It can't be supported, it's a lie, and everything in it makes no sense at all. And that's pretty tough to do if you're a traditional Jew. So this is the way he expresses it. In source 7, know that with a belief in the creation of the world in time, all the miracles become possible, and the law, meaning the Torah, becomes possible, and all questions that may be asked on this subject vanish. But the belief in eternity, the way Aristotle sees it, that is the belief according to which the world exists in virtue of necessity, like a mechanistic chain, that no nature changes at all, and that the customary course of events cannot be modified with regard to anything, right? Seas can't split. Seas are seas. They don't just suddenly go like this, right? This, says the Rambam, destroys the Torah in its principle, gives lie to every miracle, and reduces to inanity, right? To just sheer foolish prattle. All the hopes the Torah has held out, right? Now, what's really, really wonderful about this passage is that he very, very accurately and with a good deal of power explains exactly what the implications are if you think philosophically about the Bible for being a practicing traditional Jew, which is that if you think about God as unchanging, if you think about perfection as not change, etc., that whole sequence we've discussed, then the Bible is simply telling you fairy tales or lies, or things that are primitive, but certainly not anything that an sort of up-to-date, sophisticated person can believe in. Well, that's the toppling of the edifice of religion. And Maimonides feels the heat, and he knows that this is going to be a very, very big problem if we buy into the Aristotelian system the whole way. Are we clear so far? I didn't say are we happy, just are we clear? Okay. Yeah, you have a question. Sure.
One of the things I'm struggling with is the idea that the possibility of change necessarily raises the issue of better or worse. Maybe it's just different, which would not indicate a derogatory view of the previous and an improved view of the subsequent.
Right. Right. Shane's question, right to the point, right? Which is, why does change imply better or worse? I don't know that Aristotle would use the words better or worse, but I think he would think in terms of possible, not possible. It's not about, It's not that if the ball does something that the ball wasn't supposed to do, it's better or worse. It's just not possible. He's thinking in very kind of scientific, mechanistic terms, right? What's more intriguing is that Maimonides pretty much, hook and ladder, accepts this view as probably the most accurate way of rendering the divine. So he's in a bit of a fight all the way around. I've noted this for many years, that to be kind of, I wouldn't say in the middle, but to be struggling with different traditions like Maimonides does is actually much, much harder than to just dump one of the sides. You know, like by contrast, Spinoza, who has no fidelity to the biblical text, has no problem saying that the Bible is a bunch of foolish rubbish created by the ancient Hebrews, because he's fully committed to the philosophical position that God is not a being that changes, and he doesn't feel the pressure of trying to satisfy some sort of biblical tradition or Jewish practice. On the other hand, to use a different example that you sometimes crops up in the contemporary Jewish world, there are people with beliefs, let's say, on the more extreme right-wing end of orthodoxy who, in order to maintain absolute fidelity to the text, will deny any kind of scientific discoveries, anything that kind of mess with their pure understanding of the one side. So they dump the other side. Here it's science and philosophy that get sacrificed, and we maintain fidelity to the biblical text. But what do you do if you want to have your philosophical cake and eat it too? You're left really dancing very, very much on the head of a pin, which is what he's trying to do. He's trying to maintain his belief that perfection really isn't about change, and yet freedom is about change, and how do you do that? It's not a simple matter. We'll see a kind of, quote, quasi-solution that he tries, and we'll leave it up to you to decide if you like the solution. Yeah. Yes, that's a wonderful question as well, right? The question is, why is fixing an imperfect world a sign of imperfection? To put it in crude terms, that's not God's problem. In other words, God is perfect, so perfect doesn't change. The world may be imperfect, and the world may need a lot of fixing, but that's not God's issue to fix it. The perfect is perfect by definition because it doesn't have to do anything else. So I get the question, and actually it makes a lot of sense, and actually there are a lot of non-Maimonideans who would agree with you, right? If, you know, if we were, say, talking about Abraham Joshua Heschel, who is at great odds with Maimonides' position, is pained by Maimonides' picture of God, and says so explicitly and believes in the God of the Bible, a God who cares about the orphan, the widow, and so on. And so he absolutely is at, you know, great pains to say that Maimonides is applying Greek thought to a biblical text and that he's wrong and that this is not what the Torah is trying to narrate. But I guess if they were in a room together, one sort of yelling in thickly European-accented English and the other kind of mumbling in Arabic, they would be arguing, and Maimonides would say, well, but God is God. In other words, there's a certain static, unchangeable definition of what the divine is. And so people are committed to their thought systems, is another way of saying that. And once they're committed to their thought systems, you have to negotiate what you do with any kind of data or evidence that is contrary to that thought system, right? The example I cited a moment ago, that if there are sectors, let's say, of the Haredi world who want to deny the existence, say, of dinosaurs or of other kinds of scientific data, the age of the world, et cetera, because it conflicts with their thought system. It's the same kind of internal tension. What do you do with evidence that doesn't match the picture of the world you want to construct? That's true for everyone. It's true for you, it's true for me, it's true for the Rambam, it's true for Spinoza, it's true for the head of the Eda Haredit, it's true for everyone, right? People have certain commitments to a worldview, and it's depends what they do with the evidence that conflicts with it. But your point is well taken, and the truth is that there are people who completely agree with how you've expressed it. We're going to go on. I'll get you in a couple of minutes. So Maimonides begins to try and construct a difficult solution. You know, famously, Wittgenstein once said that the goal of philosophy is to lure the fly out of the bottle. A wonderful phrase. And in essence, that's what the Rambam's trying to do. He's trying to coax out a solution from a very, very difficult, constricted problem. Let's see how he does it in stages, beginning with source number 9. He says, I've already made it known to you that the foundation of the whole Torah is the view that God has brought the world into being out of nothing, what's known as creation ex nihilo. There is a discussion of creation, this is not our topic today, though it's a great topic, about whether when we talk about what is called in Hebrew yesh me'ayin, whether it's really talking about something from nothing or something after nothing. The latter is the phrase that I prefer, because something from nothing suggests that there's actually some sort of materiality, paradoxically, that God is taking the world out of and making. But God does not take from, right? So there's some sort of mysterious process that takes place after there is nothing, and suddenly there is something, there is a world. In any case, look at the next sentence. He writes, everything was created simultaneously, right? Which immediately will tweak in the reader that this does not conform with the biblical picture of sequential creation. This is crucial, because actually what the Rambam is telling you here is that the narrative, the sort of mythology of the opening chapters of Genesis is not literal. There is no such thing as sequential creation. There is no such thing as time for the God's eye view. So in other words, there is no day 1, 2, 3, 4, the sun followed by this, by this, but rather, everything happens at the same time. How can that be? We'll see. Everything was created simultaneously, then gradually all things became differentiated. They have compared this to what happens when an agricultural laborer sows various kinds of grain in the soil at the same moment. Some of them sprout within a day, others within 2 days, others again within 3 days. Though everything was sowed at the same time. You see where he's going here. Like all of creation is just one unit and things pop up, so to speak, at various times based on various factors. Because he is trying to, as I said, walk the tightrope. So he wants to virtually eliminate the idea that God is, quote, reacting in time. He's trying to create a universe where somehow everything was created at the same time, even the splitting of the sea, even us talking right now, and that's the creation in which God does not change. And then, based on whatever kind of factors are going on, suddenly these things pop into being, right? It's almost an impossible thing to really understand. The way I say it to myself, because after all, I have a very lowbrow imagination, is almost like the world is either this incredibly infinite algorithm in which everything's like set up and suddenly emerges, or the image I like for myself, the universal snack machine, in which all choices, everything that could possibly be, are there. And depending on what humans do at any given moment, they just kind of emerge. But it's all preset, right? Now, you can see exactly what he's doing here philosophically. I'm trying to square between perfection and freedom. Does it work? That's a choice you're going to have to make, and it's worth reading it in depth. A very nice explanation by David Gutman in Chakira, in source number 10, that will help us deconstruct number 9, and then I haven't forgotten about you. We're going to take your question. It would seem that Rambam understands the first days of creation not as describing temporal events, but rather as a hierarchical and sequential description of the causes and effects that make up the physical universe. Do we understand that sentence? He doesn't make one thing after the other after the other. He sets up everything as a cause and effect chain, and then they just roll each other over, one after the other after the other. The divine will is described as sowing. Once the seed is placed, the plant grows on its own. By sowing, man causes plants to grow, just as the divine will is the cause of creation. The subsequent 6 days, they're not really 6 days, they're cause and effect. They reflect the sequence of cause and effect, that brings about the development in Act Two, in actuality, of the original divine will. As the laws of nature are activated, there's a sequence of events where one event causes another. In other words, the first 6 days don't describe the actualization of things, but the process of how things will be actualized. It's a metaphor for the cause and effect of nature rather than a description historically of what took place on day one, day two, day three, day four, and so on. Rambam understands that the 6 days of creation reflect the sequence of cause and effect that end up in the actualization of our current universe. Miracles, then, are the natural result of cause and effect put into place at creation, part of the fabric of the universe. Having established that the phenomena we perceive as miracles are really natural events that occur infrequently. So that's an interesting definition, or maybe once in infinity, right? A definition that I personally do not really think I accept, but I understand the mentality behind it because I don't think it's about frequency. But anyway, having established that miracles are really natural events that occur infrequently, Rambam now addresses the issue of what are the conditions necessary to trigger those events, right? Why is the sea splitting, right, in chapter 14 of Exodus as opposed to before or after, right? What are the conditions? If it is a giant algorithm or snack machine and everything's programmed in, why do certain things emerge when they do? That's the question that comes next, right? Are miracles the result of a new divine will that is a response to a specific need, right? That's what the question before was talking about. Or are they a consequence of the original will? Is God changing kind of later on, or is it all just pre-programmed at the beginning? So in a sense, the way I've termed it in the subtitle that comes next, these are pre-designed disruptions of the natural order. Okay, we're going to take your question now. Wow. I answered one question. What a relief. There's no it. I mean, you could take it any which way you like. You could look at it metaphorically, allegorically. You could look at it at that God has designated that if you do this, this is what will happen, right? So, you know, in a very, very sort of simple kind of, right. But I mean, like, if you're put it almost like in toddler terms, right? So I design my kitchen, right? In my kitchen, there's a stove and the stove has settings. So I know that if I turn it on to 400 degrees and if somebody comes along and puts their hand on it, it'll get burned. So from the beginning of creation, the stove, so to speak, is waiting to activate, right? And along come the Egyptians and they do a certain thing and they get burned, right? So on a, you know, obviously a meta sophisticated extraction from that principle, that's essentially what's being argued here, that everything is there. And in some very mysterious kind of infinitely complex weave, what you do triggers this kind of pre-designed response, right? Now, I want to stress, because this is what always strikes me, that when you look at this response and you say, it doesn't quite work for me, realize the conditions that are prompting this solution are, again, what do you do as a Jew when you're trying to serve two masters? And that's actually a harder question to answer because he really is committed to the notion that somewhere in there, the Bible has to be backbone of something. Now, he spends a lot of time in the first book of the guide redoing the lexicography of what words mean in the guide. As you know, right, he'll say when it says God walks, talks, gets jealous, none of that is true. It's all metaphorical. So he's done his best to eliminate the Bible as an antagonist towards philosophical purity. He's basically turned everything into metaphorical because God doesn't have a body. He doesn't have parts. Fine. But that can only take you so far. What happens when that partless, invisible, incorporeal God does things? according to the Bible. Now the stakes are raised and it just becomes harder and harder and harder to explain, but he is still stuck between the two masters he's trying to serve. So he is going to give it his best shot at doing this. By the way, I am convinced, just based on the way Maimonidean thinking works, that were you to say to him, let's say, you know, 1,000 years later he comes and, you know, all the philosophers and the scientists all gather together and they say, you know, we don't like your solution. I don't know that he'd be taken aback. I think he would say, fine, find me a better one. But find me a better one that satisfies these two things, because these are two truths I believe in. So if you're Spinoza, you say to him, give up one of the sides. And if you're Haredi, you say, give up the other side. But he's not willing to. This is what I'm trying to say. He's not willing to. He believes in the truths of both, right? That's what makes him a traditionalist. There's something about the Jewish narrative in which the Bible can't just be discarded, even though many times it seems like a big pain in the neck for him. The Torah itself seems like the biggest problem, right? Because it just seems so pagan and so filled with anthropomorphism and so filled with things that are, you know, philosophically corrupted. What do I do with this thing? The problem is he can't get rid of it. It is something he believes in. It is also the code of behavior that he deeply feels is the best code, right? He believes that the Torah is a superior system of life, teaching moral behavior, as he says, correct beliefs, necessary opinions, right practices. So we're not throwing out this text come heck or high water, but he is also, he has integrity. He is absolutely committed to philosophical rationalism. So whatever solution you come up with, whether it's in the 12th century, the 20th, the 28th, he's still going to believe that these are the truths that need to be satisfied. Yes. Okay.
What you're describing is all linear and it's all laid out. And
is there a question here, or I'm not clear where you're going?
Like I'm just a little bit troubled by it.
Just a little bit. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to answer you because all I would do is repeat what I've said heretofore, so that wouldn't be useful. Yeah. 18. Oh, okay. 18.
See,
one of the problems with the Maimonides is that once one domino falls, it's like all of Judaism now is like falling, and you've got to answer 1,800 questions all at the same time, which I can't do. So I'm just going to say that you're quite right in picking up on the fact that if you're committed to this picture of God as being, meaning just the ground of being without kind of flux or change, then what's the nature of the relationship between human beings and that being is very troubling. I think I actually talked about that here last year when I did a piece on Maimonides and Heschel, so I don't really want to go through it all again. The short form answer, though, would be that God is certainly not going to move to you, but Maimonides does hold out the somewhat elitist hope that you can inch your way towards God through a series of maneuvers which are described in various writings. So whether positive knowledge of God is possible remains kind of up for discussion, Maimonides. He spends a lot of time talking about the things you shouldn't think as opposed to the things that you can think. But I would say that you're right, that it is everything becomes up for discussion, prayer, providence, the whole nine yards. That's right. And to add to that, the problem is that there's this kind of split view of the contradictions in Maimonides. Why does he say, why does he faithfully codify prayer in the Halachic Code and Mishnah Torah and so on? So that's a whole other, that's a whole other discussion, which has engendered basically a cottage industry in the Rambam. There's a cottage industry of, in Jewish studies, just trying to describe whether Maimonides believed in both sides or was hiding one side and really the other, right? So the academics believe the philosophers are the real Rambam, and the Frum Jews believe that the Halakhah is the real Rambam, and then people are trying to merge them, synthesize them. There's the Straussian view that he was esoteric, and on and on and on and on, right? So we're not going to solve that here. But the questions are correct, in other words, and they all emerge from the same problem, which is what you want to do when you want to have faith to a text which basically seems pagan, in which God is emotional and reactive and so on, needs to be appeased, needs to be sacrificed to, and so on. And the philosophical tenet, which believes in rationality and purity, how do you do that? I'd point out, however, that Maimonides' quandary really is a Jewish quandary, which is how does a, you know, rational thinking human being in 2017 square this circle as well? And you can get mad at the Rambam, but you're sort of left holding the same ball that he was. I'm going to move on. Let's take a little bit longer look at pre-established or pre-designed disruptions of the natural order. One of Maimonides' favorite, I would say, stratagems or maneuvers in the guide is to say, almost to throw up his hands and go, what, me? I'm not saying anything new. The sages say this stuff. He loves to do that because it obviously gives him support, covers his flank traditionally, and he's definitely found what he needs in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot in Source 11, in which the Mishnah says 10 things were created Bein HaShmashot, at the twilight of Shabbat, Erev Shabbat. Those are the mouth of the earth that swallowed Korach, the mouth of Miriam's well, of Bilaam's donkey, the rainbow, the manna, Moshe's staff, the shamir, the sort of worm that cut the stone, the writing, right, and the inscription, and the luchot. He sees this as a very significant sentence because it's talking about things that seem to have emerged much later, so to speak, in history, as having already been created in the original kind of slot of creation. And so in commenting on this Mishnah, Maimonides says the following in Source 12. The sages do not believe that there is periodic change of the divine will. Rather, at the beginning of the fashioning of the phenomena, God instituted into nature, through them, there would be fashioned all that would be fashioned. Whether the phenomena which would be fashioned would be frequent, i.e. natural phenomenon, or infrequent, namely an oat or a mophate, they are all equal. Thus they said at twilight on the sixth day, God instituted into the nature of the earth that Korach and his company would sink into it, and concerning the well, that it would bring forth water, concerning the donkey, that it would speak, and similarly for the rest. Should you ask if all miraculous events are in reality natural phenomena, why were these 10 particularized? The Mishnah is merely teaching us that only these were created at dusk. The other miracles were instilled into nature at the time of their original creation. For example, on the second day, when the waters were separated, they had it in their nature so that the Yam Suf should split for Moshe, the Yarden for Yoshua, and so for Eliyahu and Elisha. And on the fourth day, when the sun was created, it had in its nature that it should stop at a certain time when Yoshua spoke to it. And the same applies for all the other miracles. So you can see him pouncing on any kind of relevant rabbinic support he can find for this notion of pre-designed disruptions that are kind of embedded in creation. And he goes on further in Shmona Prakim, his introduction to Avot in chapter 8, to say this in source number 13. We believe that God's will was present during the 6 days of creation, and that all things always behave according to their nature, as it says in Kohelet, only that shall happen which has happened. Only that shall occur which has occurred. There is nothing new under the sun. Now, I am dubious that Kohelet was looking at this verse as a piece of philosophical legerdemain, But he does what Jews do, which is to take verses and use them in whichever fashion they need for the task at hand. And so he leaps upon that phrase that actually everything that happened has already happened. And he says, you see, that's actually exactly what I'm saying, that everything that's going to happen has already been set in creation. Therefore, he continues, the rabbis found it necessary to say that all the miracles that already happened, that will happen in the future as promised, and that are irregular, all were willed during the first 6 days of creation. So now he's found a partner in crime. He really has. Well, he's trying to make it work. Those things had in their original nature the novel behavior that occurred later at a set time. And when that happened at a fortuitous time, people perceived them as if they were willed now. That is not so. So that's really quite remarkable, right? You take this supposition, you plug it in, and now you call everybody else kind of naive and unaware, right? Which is that you thought like splitting the sea was actually happening today? Nah. It happened, you know, right at the beginning. It's just sort of coming out. Where were you? You know, so this is not a new thing, kind of, right? So there's something kind of funny about this, but you can see he's clearly committed to finding this as the solution between the two masters. He finds other support for this, right? In a midrash in source 14, Bereshit Rabbah. The rabbis write in the midrash, God made a condition with nature at the creation that the sea should divide, to let the Israelites pass through it at the Exodus, and that nature should alter her course when emergency should arise. That's pretty good proof, you know? It's based on a wordplay of the word etan, but anyway, of condition and sea. But it's interesting, right? And referring to this midrash, the Rambam writes in the guide, this notion consists in their holding the view, Chazal, that miracles too are something that in a certain respect, right, is in nature. God put it into these natures that all miracles that occurred would be produced in them at the time when they occurred. Okay, so that's the argument. You don't have to like it, accept it, but that's how fortuitous, right?
But it also robs us of free will.
Why does it rob you of free will? Do whatever you like. How do you know that the choice you make will trigger this, and the choice you'll make will trigger that? No, but that's life. You know, in other words, the choices you make are real and the consequences are real, and there'll be different consequences depending on the choice you make. If you decide, after having drunk 6 beers, to get into the car in the rainstorm at 12 at night and run the red light and hit the person, that was a choice and that was a consequence. It didn't have to be. You could have stayed home and gone to sleep, right? All choices have infinite repercussions that are set out. He's not telling you to get in the car. He's not telling you to drink the beer. He's not telling you anything. Maybe an infinite variety of consequences. It depends on whether you think that the world runs according to a mechanized design as opposed to the kinds of things that'll happen. It also depends on whether you think, and this is a whole other topic, that God looks at each person providentially in the same way. In other words, is thinking about your life in the same way he's thinking about Moshe Rabbeinu's life and so on. That is not the way it comes out in the guide, and that's a whole other complicated matter. So there may just be a general net of the way the world works as opposed to specifically looking over. But I think it's quite logical to say that there are conditions under which the world operates, and you work within those conditions, and those things happen. I don't think God's looking over your shoulder when you get in the car at all. Well, we can argue about that in another instance. Yeah.
What does this mean? God made a condition with nature? Bargaining?
That's midrashic language. In other words, it's a way of describing the notion that the world is constructed such, right, that certain things happen as a result of other things. God doesn't talk to anyone. And so it is. We're not, but he's not taking it literally. In other words, he's taking it as a philosophical construct that somehow there is a notion that time is not something that just occur, you know, events in time with God don't happen. It's not like later on he's splitting the sea. So he is reading it allegorically, you know. Anyway, I'm just, you know, it's like when people are upset that their flight is delayed. I'm just the guy at the checkout counter. I'm not the head of the airline. I just want to make that clear. Let's look at objections, and there were many. There were many objections in modernity to miracles, and Spinoza in the Tractatus, which is published posthumously. As you know, Spinoza has a short life, 1632 to 1677. The speculation is he's a glass grinder. He makes glasses. The speculation is that he maybe died from TB or some kind of lung ailment because of glass dust. It's not clear. But in any case, he is proclaimed a heretic by the Amsterdam community in 1645, a charge which I might say he happily cops to. You know, he doesn't think they're wrong, and is excommunicated and spends the rest of his life somewhat calmly and sanguinely outside of the Jewish community. And this text is published posthumously. It's published anonymously. In other words, he does not have his name on it right away. Nothing then comes to pass in nature in contravention to our universal laws. Okay, so there you have it. You know, we've been dancing around this issue, you know, philosophy, Torah, and Spinoza's just like, sorry. Nature's nature, it doesn't change, you don't, the seas don't split, that's the deal. Everything agrees with them, the laws of nature, and falls from them, for whatsoever comes to pass by the will and eternal decree of God, according to laws and rules which evolve eternal necessity and truth. Nature, therefore, always observes laws and rules which involve eternal necessity and truth, although they may not all be known to us. And therefore, she keeps a fixed and immutable order, right? So as I aired before, the book was published in his lifetime in 1670, but not under his name right away. So according to Spinoza in 17, God is free in the sense that there's no external cause to which God is subject, but it's not true that God is endowed with free will, as we normally understand the term. It makes no sense to say that God can change his mind or will something other than what is determined by God's nature, a position that stands in direct contrast to Maimonides, where will is defined by the ability to will and not to will. So that's a straight up argument, right? Spinoza, probably quite irritated at the idea that Maimonides feels he has to pay homage to the Bible when he clearly understands that philosophically the position is that God doesn't change and seas don't split and so on. So Spinoza takes the step clearly that the Rambam is not willing to take. But all of this is still taking place as an argument about kind of science, laws of nature, and so on. Not about how do you know that God does this stuff? The Bible tells me. Oh, what's the Bible? Right? As modernity deepens, and Spinoza is really in many ways kind of the first, one of the first to really start laying this on the table in a big way, attention now gets paid to the very source which proclaims that God does this and does that. And it's that source that comes under attack. And it reaches a very clear articulation in David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, in source 18. And he goes right after, who told you this was a miracle? In other words, who narrated this event? How do we know the sea is split? Oh, the Bible. And what's the Bible a record of? You mean the way ancient people understood reality? They're dupes. He's not going after nature and laws of nature and so on. He's going after, like, where does this even come from and why should I trust it? And he says in 18, there's not to be found in all history any miracle attested by a sufficient number of men of such unquestioned good sense, education, and learning as to secure us against all delusion in themselves, or of such undoubted integrity as to place them beyond all suspicion of any design to deceive others, of such credit and reputation in the eyes of mankind as to have a great deal to lose in case of their being detective in any falsehood. In other words, it's a con. It's a flim-flam. Who are these guys? What do they know? They're primitives. Why should their understanding of reality mean that, like, this stuff happened? That's essentially how Hume goes after it. Yeah.
I don't know Hume well enough. What can you say this about the Christian Bible too?
Oh, he's an atheist. He thinks, yeah, oh, absolutely, you know. When Kenneth Ziskind summarizes it, he says the following in 19, according to this passage, the key issue is evidence. Since those who wrote biblical history were interested parties, in other words, they're trying to sell you, right? They're trying to sell you that this is God and this is what he wants and this is what he'll do if you don't comply. Since they're interested parties, there's a tendency for people to enjoy the telling and hearing of exotic exploits, what Hume calls the usual propensity of mankind towards the marvelous. And since the Israelites were a primitive people, their testimony cannot be considered authoritative. Testimony that can be considered authoritative might contain astonishing facts, but it could not contain anything miraculous. Now, you see, that's also a problem, because what Hume does is, remember I talked before about how everybody has a worldview and they just deal with stuff according to the worldview. So Hume's worldview is that miracles aren't possible, period. So if miracles aren't possible, if somebody tells you that they happen, you basically have to suspect that what they're saying is wrong by definition. So it's a circular argument. If miracles aren't really possible, they're just like things that might be like weird or astonishing. But if they happen, then your testimony is by definition dubious, right? So that's a construct that you can't get out of, really, right? Yeah. Yeah, no, because they don't believe in the Bible as authoritative. They don't need to resort to that. They don't need to resort. They do not need to defend the text at all, right? And in some ways, it's a corrupt argument because, look, as Yechezkel Kaufman, the great biblical scholar, tells us in 20, it wasn't the priests or the people who parted the waters of the Jordan or laid fat the walls of Jericho. They did what God ordered at the time God's word came to pass. This idea shaped the narratives of the real events even as they came into being at the earliest stage of their oral creation, from the moment when the happenings were formed into a story in the mouth of those who had lived them, stamped with the idea of the miraculous sign. They told it the way they saw it, right? These were the stories they were told. The people who experienced these events narrated them that way because I don't know if the sea split or it didn't split, but something happened, these stories are telling us, and this is how it seemed to me. So why are you impugning me, right? That's what biblical narrative is about, right? So as we see in Source 21, the participants did the best job they could of describing the facts. The problem is not so much that they were given to flights of fancy as that the categories at their disposal were different from ours, right? How would you describe electricity in the 3rd century? How would you describe all the things that we have very, very nice, technical, ordered, scientific language for? You'd say it differently. So the Bible is saying things differently, and whether it's saying those things inaccurately is another question. But it's saying it exactly the way you would experience it at that time. Lastly, so I really think that nobody's really proved anything here conclusively, and it really depends to where you are inclined and what seems convincing for you. And people will be very convinced about their own convictions. So in fact, even in a system that seems as untainted by anything fabulous, as in fable-like, as science, we know for a fact that people are convinced of certain ways of thinking until they're not, and until those paradigms are overturned, as Thomas Kuhn put it so well in his great book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he writes in 22, discovery commences with the awareness of anomaly, with the recognition that nature has somehow violated the paradigm-induced expectations that govern normal science. Things are as they are until they're not. And then what do you do? And then what do you say, right? So why is the Bible so weird, right? We know in the world that things are just accepted as they are and then suddenly they're broken and now we have a new way of explaining it and this happens over and over and over again. However, you know, it's complicated. It's not the same as the biblical narrative. And perhaps for some people the red lines are drawn. Certainly for Richard Dawkins, the molecular biologist, the lines are drawn, as he says in his classically nasty way. In 23, when pressed, many educated Christians are too loyal to deny the virgin birth and the resurrection, but it embarrasses them because their rational minds know that it is absurd, right? But already you're applying your constructions, right? I've decided it's absurd, therefore it is irrational to believe it, and so on. I'm going to leave you with a thought from C.S. Lewis, right, the Christian theologian, in 24. If this week I put £1,000 in the drawer of my desk, add 2,000 next week and another 1,000 the week thereafter, the laws of arithmetic allow me to predict the next time I come to the drawer, I shall find £4,000. But suppose when I next open the drawer, I find only £1,000. What shall I conclude? That the laws of arithmetic have been broken? Certainly not. I might more reasonably conclude that some thief has broken the laws of the state and stolen £3,000 out of my drawer. One thing it would be ludicrous to claim is that the laws of arithmetic make it impossible to believe in the existence of such a thief or the possibility of his intervention. You can see what he's doing here and who the thief is. On the contrary, it is the normal workings of those laws that have exposed the existence and the activity of the thief. Now, that's a very neat inversion, right? The very fact that there are such laws means that the only possible explanation is God, because there's an intervention that takes place. It's not that the laws are negated by God, it's that there are laws and then there's a thief. So says Lewis. And even John Lennox, professor of math at Oxford, writes, Newton's law of gravitation tells me if I drop an apple, it'll fall towards the center of the earth, but that law doesn't prevent someone intervening and catching the apple as it descends. In other words, the law predicts what will happen, provided there's no change in the conditions under which the experiment is conducted. So you can draw your own conclusion. We in Israel live by Ben-Gurion's axiom in 26, that in order to be a realist in Israel, you must believe in miracles. Thank you very much.